Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Now that you've had some time to digest the NCAA bracket, it is time to go to work. Start to fill that bad boy in. Now, how do you go about doing that? Like, do you pick up a pencil and do you work it out match by matchup, matchup by matchup, round by round? Or do you start with the Final Four and try to work backwards? Or do you have the confidence to go with a pen from the very beginning and to turn in a perfect bracket? You know, one without a single crossout or second thoughts. How are you doing this? And then what's your actual strategy in making your decisions? Are you using computer simulations? Are you going with your gut? What's your 12-5 upset? Haven't been as many of those lately, but everybody's got that 12-5. Do you have a 13 over a 4? Maybe even a 14 over a 3? I'm looking at you, Yale versus LSU. We know a 16 can beat a 1, but do you have the guts to call that shot again this year? Speaking of guts, how are you feeling about Virginia this year? If you were burned by them last year, what is your approach this year? Will they get redemption? Are you going to go with a jungle karma bracket and just put Fairleigh Dickinson into the Final Four right now? Because as good as Greg Horrenda was when he came back on the show in 2016, back then, he was even better yesterday. I'm still running on the Horrenda juice right now. This guy was absolutely amazing on the program. And the karma is strong with him, but he'd be the first to tell you that they've got a battle, Alvin. A battle on their hands tonight against Prairie View A&M. And you can tell that he was very concerned about how they get after you on defense. Tomorrow night against Prairie View A&M.
We got to win a game, man. And ultimately, and I know you've got to go, but our goal, we've never won.
Coach, I got nowhere to be. You take your time.
But I'm just telling you, bro, this is going to be an exciting game because Prairie View really, really guards. They're like, when I was at Holy Cross, we played Arkansas the 40 minutes of hell the year before they won the whole thing. And they're not, you know, obviously Arkansas won a national championship, but at our levels, they're the Arkansas of the SWAC, and they're really well coached. Byron Smith really gets after it. A lot of respect for them. So it's going to be a dogfight.
What's that mean? Prairie View's got a Corliss Williamson, Scotty Thurman. This guy was so good yesterday. And I said to him, one of your favorite lines, one of the things you always tell your team is, be judged by what you're not supposed to do. I couldn't wait to ask him that, and he couldn't wait to be asked about that. Now, one of the things you've said is, quote, I tell our team all the time that you will forever be judged by what you're not supposed to do.
You're the best.
I love that quote. Tell me what you mean by that.
Amen, brother. I just think in life, anyone could do the ordinary. And these guys, if we win a game, it's history. And they'll forever be remembered by something that they probably shouldn't do. You know, we're not beating out people. We got guys that go to McDonald's, man. We don't get McDonald's All-Americans. So when these kids come, it's just all in front of us. It's a dream. And then when you realize that dream, Rome, it's, you know the feeling. It's euphoric. Don't be ordinary, man. Don't be ordinary. Come to Fairleigh Dickinson. You're going to be different. We were 1-4, Rome, in our conference to start the season. And then we won 15 out of 17 to this day.
Are you going to tell me you're not going to watch him? Are you going to tell me you're not going to watch that first game, hearing that guy? And then he ended the interview like a freaking boss. Greg, listen, I know you got work to do, and you do have work to do. Good luck. Good luck. We'll be watching.
Hey, Rome,
and if you win that game, you know I'm looking for you.
I can't appreciate your time anymore, man. You are the greatest. Your homework, your research, and your love, I feel it, and I really, really appreciate it totally, and I thank you so much.
Can't wait to see them play. They're going to tip it off. 3:40 Pacific, first game. That's coming up later today. Who do you got in that one? Listen, let me tell you what I will not be doing. I will not be telling you how to fill out your bracket, but I know you will be filling out a bracket. So there's a decent chance that you might even not only do that, but get down with some legal sports betting. I can't lie. I'm going to. So if you're like that and you're like pretty much everybody else on the planet, you know Duke's going to be in your Final Four. And you've probably got Duke winning the whole thing. To call Duke the heavy favorite is a heavy understatement. They're the heaviest favorite in years. They're the 2-1 favorite in many spots, which makes them the heaviest favorite since undefeated Kentucky back in 2014-2015. And that Kentucky team made it to the Final Four before they were upset by Wisconsin. This year's field is stacked, but let's be real. The tournament is all about Duke and Zion. And for good reason. In Zion Williamson, Coach K has got the most dominant weapon in college basketball. And not just this season, but in many years. This guy is an absolute force. And if you didn't know it before he was hurt, you know it right now. Because Duke is a different team since he came back. And as I've said before, he is the best player in college basketball since the guy that you think is the best player ever. Pick the best college player ever in your own mind. Zion is the best player since that guy. And he's got two other top 10 picks right alongside RJ Barrett, Cam Reddish. And they get after it. And the most impressive thing about Zion's game isn't even the athleticism. It's that the guy competes for everything. There is no off switch for the big man. He's diving on the floor. He's jumping into passing lanes. He's rejecting shots that he's got no business reaching. In other words, he doesn't just kill you with dunks. He kills you with putbacks and tip-ins. And the rest of the team follows suit. They play hard. They compete. But this is the NCAA tournament. And because of that, there's always a but. If you want a reason to pick against Duke or a reason to be worried that you're picking Duke, here it is. Duke is not a good three-point shooting team. In fact, they're crappy. They're a really poor three-point shooting team, which is shocking given their talent. They went into the ACC tournament title game ranked 333rd in the country in three-point shooting. They hit less than 25% from deep in the ACC tourney. Duke fans will point to that number and say, yeah, well, look at the ACC tournament trophy. They don't care. Hit less than 25%, still win, which tells you how good this team is. Forget 25%. They went 2-for-14 against Florida State, which is 14%, and they still won by double digits. And that tells you that if they actually ever do start doing anything from deep, they're going to be impossible to beat. But everybody has been waiting all season long for that switch to be flipped, and it hasn't happened. It's been a consistent issue. And it means if they get in deep against a good team like maybe Virginia Tech in the Sweet 16, who does shoot it well from deep and has beaten Duke once this year, they're going to have a tough time shooting their way out of it if they have to. You're not going to stop Zion, so don't even waste your time on that. Maybe try to slow him down, but to beat Duke, force them to shoot threes and then hope for the best. And given how they do shoot threes, you might not have to hope that hard. So there it is. A little advice about what you're getting into when you pick Duke and what you're getting into if you pick against Duke. And as always, here is your public service announcement. If you're wanting to call in sick on Thursday and Friday, today is the day to start setting it up. Now, don't go out too quickly. Don't go out too early. Don't start talking about your clammy hands, your cold sweats this morning. Man, work up to it. Mix in a cough, maybe two. Hold your head a little bit. Rub your temples. Talk about your scratchy throat. Just don't throw all the symptoms against the wall too early. You've got to save it for after lunch. Maybe even later in the day, because if you go too early, people will know your game. Wait until this afternoon, maybe just before you leave work tonight. Plant the seed that you're not feeling too well, but you're going to play through it. Then show up tomorrow, mention it a couple of times, let everybody know that you're battling something, and they'll think that you're willing to grind it out for coming to work on a Wednesday. And then you call in sick on Thursday and Friday, and everybody understands. And then hit it hard. You're welcome. But don't thank me now. Thank me when it works. Set it up the right way. Taco Fall is my guest. Taco, it's so nice to have you on. How are you?
Yes, sir. I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing great. It's great to visit with you. So UCF is going to the NCAA tournament, Taco, for the first time in 14 years. What was it like on Selection Sunday when you saw the team's name come up and you knew that you were going to go to the tournament?
I mean, that feeling was just indescribable. We've been waiting for this moment I mean, ever since I got to UCF, that's something that I've been wanting to do, and it wasn't easy. The guys were in a lot of work. You know, we went through a lot as a team, but we fought through it, fought through a lot of injuries last couple of years. But most of the guys came back, and we built the chemistry up, and we were finally able to pull it off. I mean, it was just indescribable.
No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors. With thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game, when the pressure is on, count on Ferguson. Taco Fall, my guest, what about you individually? For instance, I want to get to your journey in a minute, but when you decide to go to UCF, it had been a program that had not been having a lot of basketball success. So what's it mean to you personally to be a part of the team that brought that program back to the NCAA tournament?
It means a lot. I mean, coming to UCF, I wanted to leave my mark. I wanted to do something that's, I mean, that not many people were able to do, and I'm blessed to be able to, you know, accomplish that and be in that position. But that's definitely something that I wanted to do, come to UCF and leave my legacy here. And I've worked towards that the last 4 years. And I just put my head down and I was like, I'm going to do it. And I've had a lot of help with, you know, the coaches, with my teammates. And it's just, I'm blessed to be able to be in that position.
UCF big man Taco Fall is my guest. Now, as I mentioned, your journey really is remarkable. Take me back. When you were growing up in Senegal, the story goes that your grandmother liked basketball. What did you think of basketball, though? Were you a basketball guy or maybe more of a soccer guy?
I was more of a soccer guy. I mean, I played soccer, not organized soccer, but like for fun. Back home, most of the kids play soccer. So after school, sometimes we would go, especially during summer breaks, we would just play soccer all the time. But my grandmother was really the basketball fan in the house. I wasn't really into basketball. I didn't understand the rules or anything. But I started getting pretty tall, and people started approaching my mom about me, like, potentially playing. But I never went through with it until I was 16 years old. And that's when I met this guy from this Flying Star Academy. His name was Ibrahim. He came over to my mom and talked to her about the possibility of me being able to come over to the States and being able to pursue my education, because that was very important for my mom. And at the same time, started to train and become a basketball player. And she accepted. And 6 months later, I was on my way here, and I was on my way to Houston.
Taco Fall joining us. That's amazing. So just so we're clear, how old were you when you left your family in Senegal and you came to the United States? How old were you? And at that point, how much basketball had you played?
I was 16. The amount of basketball, probably for like 6 months. That was the time that I spent at that Flying Star Academy. The guy that came over and talked to my mom. But before that, I never really played basketball. And then my first basketball game was here in Houston. When I came over here to state.
You talk about, it seems from the outside anyway, it seems like that would be incredibly hard and really brave to leave your family at such a young age. What was that like for you at that time?
It was very hard. My dad lived in Cincinnati, but I wasn't with him. I grew up pretty much with my mom. She raised me, so it was very hard not being able to be there with her and my little brother. He was 6 years old at that time, so it was just us. So leaving them behind was really hard for me. And coming to the States, I didn't know pretty much anybody. And I never played basketball before, so I had to go through the growing pains of, you know, just learning the game and everything. But thank God I was able to pick things up pretty quick, even though it wasn't easy, especially with the body type that I had. I had to get stronger, I had to get faster, because I played some soccer, but I wasn't really a great athlete. So I had to just keep working, and like I said, I had a lot of help from people just pushing me, constantly pushing me. And then the more I played the game, the more I started to like it. And then that's when I started really getting better. The more I liked it, the more I wanted to learn about the game. So I started to watch a lot of videos. I started to go on YouTube and watch a lot of great players, a lot of big special, and just started to study the game and try to replicate whatever I was watching. And just from there, I just started getting better.
UCF big man Taco Fall joining us. So when you were watching YouTube, who were some of the bigs that you were studying and you were watching?
I started with a lot of old school bigs, Kareem, Hakeem Olajuwon, some Bill Russell. There wasn't a lot of Bill Russell clips that I could find, but a lot of Bill Russell clips that I saw were more like defensive clips of him blocking shots. And he had this one called The Art of Blocking Shots. There was that in Shaq. I watched especially Shaq. And but at that time, Dwight Howard was still, you know, pretty big. So I used to watch Dwight. So mostly those bigs.
Taco Fall joining us, a big man for UCF. So Taco, earlier this month on senior night, your mother Marianne came from Senegal to watch you play. That was the first time you had seen her in 7 years. What was it like when you saw your mom at the airport?
It was very emotional, mostly on her part. I don't think she expected to see me, like, because when I left, I think I was 7'2", and I was skinny as a stick. But now I'm 7'6", 300 pounds. So when I left, I was pretty much a boy. But now she came back and saw a man, and she just broke down, and I went to comfort her, and it was really emotional.
It's incredible. So what was it like to have her at that game and to watch you play?
It was amazing. I mean, that I tried during throughout all that week. I mean, we had a pretty big game coming up, so I was really trying to lock in on the game. But at the same time, I just couldn't help but think. I felt like I was dreaming. Like, not one day have I not just thought about that moment, and finally to see it happen. It was just like I couldn't describe it how I felt.
Taco Fall, my guest. One more thing about that. You beat Cincinnati that day, and the fans stormed the court, and then you went to find your mom. I mean, it feels like something out of a movie. She described hugging you after the game as, quote, "It was like the day he was born when I held him in my arms. I can't describe the joy of seeing my son play for the first time." I mean, Taco, that is so heavy and so emotional. What was it like to share such a big win with her?
I mean, hopefully we can share many more moments like that. She's been my biggest cheerleader. She's the most important person in my life, her and my little brother pretty much. And I've had a lot of great moments, but just for the fact that both of them were there made that moment probably one of the best moments in my life ever.
Now, it's still challenging on the floor, though, right? Like, teams do not know exactly how to deal with you, and you get fouled all the time, and there have actually been times when you've heard opposing players or coaches even say, go after his knees. Yeah. What's it like when you hear that?
I used to really get mad at it because I just couldn't understand, especially where I come from, the culture where I come from. Like, how would you tell your players to do that and hurt another player, which, you know, and this is my career, this is what I love to do, and you never know what can happen. I can, you know, I can get hit wrong and my career is over just like that. So, but now I just try to fight through it and not think about it. I mean, I look at it for the referees. I mean, if people are human, people make mistakes. I don't think I get officiated, you know, like everybody else. It may be hard because I'm not like everybody else, so people get away with a lot of stuff that they do, especially when the court is so congested and I have so many people around me and all these fouls. I think that's actually how I hurt in my shoulder. I had a labrum tear from just all the banging that used to get me on the court, but now I'm just kind of used to it and try to fight through it.
Taco Fall joining me for another few moments. That said, Houston coach Kelvin Sampson said after a game, you guys had a huge, huge win. He said after the game that they did not have an answer for you, and that on defense, you take away half their playbook because of everything you do and how active you are. So how much pride do you take in the fact that you've developed your game to the point where you can take opponents completely out of the game on defense?
I mean, it's just knowing my value on the court. At some point I started realizing the gift that I had and that could really change the game in so many ways, both offensively and defensively. There's nobody in the country that has my length. And for big my size, I feel like I'm pretty mobile. I can move, and that's something that I've worked on. I've not always been like that. I've really worked hard and studied a lot of things for me to be able to get here. And now it's just about using my abilities and playing to my, you know, to the way I know I can.
Taco, you know, you mentioned Kareem, and I can remember talking to Kareem back in the day, and conversation honestly did not go very well. And I remember the comment that he had made, or somebody had made, that it's not easy to be a 7-footer in a 6-footer's world. Your friends and teammates talk about the fact that when you go out in public, people constantly want to come up to you and they want to take photographs and they want to talk to you because you're 7'6" and you're always very kind when that happens. So how do you go about dealing with that?
I mean, now I'm kind of used to it. That's how I was raised. I feel like it's kind of rude to just, when people come up to you, I always try to be as nice as possible. That's why I'm really good at it. And now I'm just kind of used to it. But at the same time, like Kareem said, it's hard to be, you know, that big, especially in this world. And I definitely don't like being seen as a freak because that's what it may seem like. But for the most part, I'm pretty nice about it. The way I think about it is, if I saw someone that was 10 feet tall, I probably would be amazed too and would try to come up to him and ask him questions and things like that. But now I feel like a lot of people know me just not by my height, but by the other things that I can do. And for me, it's just bigger than basketball. Basketball is part of, you know, it's a big thing that I do, but I'm more than that. So, yeah.
You are more than that. In fact, I know you had a deal with your mother that said that you had to get a degree and you're going to graduate as a double major. So you are more than basketball. Taco Fall, UCF center. He is the all-time leader in field goal percentage in a season and blocks in a career. They are a 9 seed in the East and they take on VCU on Friday. Taco, could not be happier to have you on the program and to meet you. Thank you very much for the conversation. Good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Are you doing a repair that needs a special tool? Why pay for a tool that you may never use ever again? O'Reilly Auto Parts makes it easy with their loaner tool program. With more than 80 specialized loaner tools available, they'll make sure to have a tool in stock to help you get the job done correctly. Purchase the needed parts and put down a deposit on that loaner tool and then return the tool in its original condition and you receive a full refund. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. Now that you've had some time to digest the NCAA bracket, it is time to go to work. Start to fill that bad boy in. Now, how do you go about doing that? Like, do you pick up a pencil and do you work it out match by matchup, matchup by matchup, round by round? Or do you start with the Final Four and try to work backwards? Or do you have the confidence to go with a pen from the very beginning and to turn in a perfect bracket, you know, one without a single cross out or second thoughts? How are you doing this? And then what's your actual strategy in making your decisions? Are you using computer simulations? Are you going with your gut? What's your 12-5 upset? Haven't been as many of those lately, but everybody's got that 12-5. Do you have a 13 over a 4? Maybe even a 14 over a 3? I'm looking at you, Yale versus LSU. We know a 16 can beat a 1, but do you have the guts to call that shot again this year? Speaking of guts, how you feeling about Virginia this year? If you were burned by them last year, what is your approach this year? Will they get redemption? Are you going to go with a jungle karma bracket and just put Fairleigh Dickinson into the Final Four right now? Because as good as Greg Horrenda was when he came back on the show in 2016, back then, he was even better yesterday. I'm still running on the Horrenda juice right now. This guy was absolutely amazing on the program. And the karma is strong with him, but he'd be the first to tell you that they've got a battle, Alvin. A battle on their hands tonight against Prairie View A&M. And you can tell that he was very concerned about how they get after you on defense. Tomorrow night against Prairie View A&M.
We got to win a game, man. And ultimately, and I know you got to go, but our goal, we've never won.
Coach, I got nowhere to be. You take your time.
But I'm just telling you, this is going to be an exciting game because Prairie View really, really guards. They're like, when I was at Holy Cross, we played Arkansas the 40 minutes of hell the year before they won the whole thing. And they're not, you know, obviously Arkansas won a national championship, but at our levels, they're the Arkansas of the SWAC, and they're really well coached. Byron Smith really gets after it. A lot of respect for them. So it's going to be a dogfight.
What's that mean? Prairie View's got a Corliss Williamson, Scotty Thurman. This guy was so good yesterday. And I said to him, one of your favorite lines, one of the things you always tell your team is, be judged by what you're not supposed to do. I couldn't wait to ask him that, and he couldn't wait to be asked about that. Now, one of the things you've said is, quote, "I tell our team all the time that you will forever be judged by what you're not supposed to do."
You're the best.
I love that quote. Tell me what you mean by that.
Amen, brother. I just think in life, anyone can do the ordinary. And these guys, if we win a game, it's history. And they'll forever be remembered by something that they probably shouldn't do. You know, we're not beating out people. We got guys that go to McDonald's, man. We don't get McDonald's All-Americans. So when these kids come, it's just all in front of us. It's a dream. And then when you realize that dream, Rome, it's, you know the feeling. It's euphoric. Don't be ordinary, man. Don't be ordinary. Come to Fairleigh Dickinson. You're going to be different. We were 1-4, Rome, in our conference to start the season. And then we won 15 out of 17 to this day.
Are you going to tell me you're not going to watch him? Are you going to tell me you're not going to watch that first game, hearing that guy? And then he ended the interview like a freaking boss. Greg, listen, I know you got work to do, and you do have work to do. Good luck. Good luck. We'll be watching.
Hey, Rome,
and if you win that game, you know I'm looking for you.
I can't appreciate your time anymore, man. You are the greatest. Your homework, your research, and your love, I feel it, and I really, really appreciate it totally, and I thank you so much.
Can't wait to see them play. They're going to tip it off. 3:40 Pacific. First game. That's coming up later today. Who do you got in that one? Listen, let me tell you what I will not be doing. I will not be telling you how to fill out your bracket. But I know you will be filling out a bracket. So there's a decent chance that you might even not only do that, but get down with some legal sports betting. I can't lie. I'm going to. So if you're like that, and you're like pretty much everybody else on the planet, you know Duke's going to be in your Final Four. And you've probably got Duke winning the whole thing. To call Duke the heavy favorite is a heavy understatement. They're the heaviest favorite in years. They're the 2-1 favorite in many spots, which makes them the heaviest favorite since undefeated Kentucky back in 2014-2015. And that Kentucky team made it to the Final Four before they were upset by Wisconsin. This year's field is stacked, but let's be real. The tournament is all about Duke and Zion. And for good reason. In Zion Williamson, Coach K has got the most dominant weapon in college basketball. And not just this season, but in many years. This guy is an absolute force. And if you didn't know it before he was hurt, you know it right now. Because Duke is a different team since he came back. And as I've said before, he is the best player in college basketball since the guy that you think is the best player ever. Pick the best college player ever in your own mind. Zion is the best player since that guy. And he's got two other top 10 picks right alongside RJ Barrett, Cam Reddish. And they get after it. And the most impressive thing about Zion's game isn't even the athleticism. It's that the guy competes for everything. There is no off switch for the big man. He's diving on the floor. He's jumping into passing lanes. He's rejecting shots that he's got no business reaching. In other words, he doesn't just kill you with dunks. He kills you with putbacks and tip-ins. And the rest of the team follows suit. They play hard. They compete. But this is the NCAA tournament. And because of that, there's always a but. If you want a reason to pick against Duke or a reason to be worried that you're picking Duke, here it is. Duke is not a good three-point shooting team. In fact, they're crappy. They're a really poor three-point shooting team, which is shocking given their talent. They went into the ACC tournament title game ranked 333rd in the country in three-point shooting. They hit less than 25% from deep in the ACC tourney. Duke fans will point to that number and say, yeah, well, look at the ACC tournament trophy. They don't care. Hit less than 25%, still win, which tells you how good this team is. Forget 25%. They went 2-for-14 against Florida State, which is 14%, and they still won by double digits. And that tells you that if they actually ever do start doing anything from deep, they're going to be impossible to beat. But everybody has been waiting all season long for that switch to be flipped, and it hasn't happened. It's been a consistent issue. And it means if they get in deep against a good team, like maybe Virginia Tech in the Sweet 16, who does shoot it well from deep and has beaten Duke once this year. They're going to have a tough time shooting their way out of it if they have to. You're not going to stop Zion, so don't even waste your time on that. Maybe try to slow him down, but to beat Duke, force them to shoot threes and then hope for the best. And given how they do shoot threes, you might not have to hope that hard. So there it is. A little advice about what you're getting into when you pick Duke and what you're getting into if you pick against Duke. And as always, here is your public service announcement. If you're wanting to call in sick on Thursday and Friday, today is the day to start setting it up. Now, don't go out too quickly. Don't go out too early. Don't start talking about your clammy hands, your cold sweats this morning. Man, work up to it. Mix in a cough, maybe two, hold your head a little bit, rub your temples, talk about your scratchy throat. Just don't throw all the symptoms against the wall too early. You've got to save it for after lunch, maybe even later in the day, because if you go too early, people will know your game. Wait until this afternoon, maybe just before you leave work tonight. Plant the seed that you're not feeling too well, but you're going to play through it. Then show up tomorrow, mention it a couple of times, let everybody know that you're battling something, and they'll think that you're willing to grind it out for coming to work on a Wednesday. And then you call in sick on Thursday and Friday, and everybody understands. And then hit it hard. You're welcome. But don't thank me now. Thank me when it works. Set it up the right way. Schooner Jeanette is my guest. Scooter, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good. What an introduction that is, Jim.
Dude,
thank you.
Dude, your resume is unbelievable, I got to say. So, Scooter, we're about 10 days out from the season opener. How has camp gone for you so far? Are you ready to start playing meaningful games right now, or maybe is there still a little work to be done?
I'm ready. I think the more, just every spring training, I get ready faster. I think this year, after about my 15th at-bat, 20th at-bat, I was ready to go. Just can't wait to get the season started.
I see you working. Now, the team itself has made a lot of moves in the offseason, including the arrival of a new manager in David Bell. You've also got Matt Kemp, Yasiel Puig, Alex Woods, Sonny Gray. The list goes on. How would you describe the vibe and the mood in camp this year?
It's great. I think the biggest thing is that the front office, they expect us to win, which we as players, we always expect to win. We think we can win on any given day with whatever team we have. But now that the front office is expecting us to win, it just seems more real. To where both sides are, have the same thought. So, with that's different from the past couple years, which is good. But all the new players, the new coaches, everybody's energy's good. The vibe's good. I think that we're gonna really surprise some people, and with our lineup and with Sonny Gray and Rorick and Wood, being pretty much our top three guys. If they do what they're supposed to, man, I mean we're gonna be scary. I don't think people are gonna want to see us come into the town.
Red second baseman Scooter Jeanette joining us. And then you've got Yasiel Puig, Scooter, who we had here in Los Angeles for a number of years. He really is a fascinating guy. What's it been like having him around? What's he bring to your clubhouse?
Oh, man. We could talk all day about that.
I got lots of time.
I would say he's a lot of fun. He enjoys himself out the field, which that's how he he's got to enjoy himself to be at the top of his game. So, he'll do some stuff out there that you've never seen before on the field. And it kind of like, wow, like what just happened right there. But then, he'll pick up the ball and throw a guy out, 300 feet away, or he'll come up and hit a grand slam. And it's just like, well, it is, that's him. It's kind of like the, Manny being Manny, in that time. It's very similar, but he's a good guy. He's smart. Just getting to know him. He cares about the team. He cares about his preparation. So, all in all, he's been great. But we got to see, you know, when we go through some ups and downs as a team, how guys respond. And, you know, that's when you really can tell, you know, how people are.
I think that's right. I think that's fair. Scooter Jeanette joining us. So now you rolled to camp last year in an RV. Take me back. How was that trip? And then how did you make the journey this year?
Oh, it was last year we were in a Cruise America RV, which that was so nice to let us loan one for the trip over. Unfortunately, I did all the driving on my own. My wife and our dog Leo were relaxing pretty much for the whole trip while I drove. But you know, that's kind of my duty as the husband. You know, just another thing that, you know, we're expected to do. But this year, we met a bus driver at the Homestead race, the NASCAR race in Homestead this year, and it was Elliot Sadler's bus driver for a long time, and Elliot Sadler retired this past year, so the bus and the bus driver weren't doing much. So I told him, you know, maybe in February I'll hit you up and see what your plans are. And sure enough, he was ready to go. And his name was Will. He's a good old country dude. A lot of one-liners. Just a great guy. It was a lot of fun. I didn't have to drive at all, and we had a satellite TV and internet. So I mean, it was a lot better than doing all the driving on my own. That's for sure.
Better. It sounds like the best roadie ever. That sounds like a blast. Hey, listen, I'm glad you mentioned NASCAR, Scooter, because as long as we're talking about NASCAR and wheels, you're a huge Dale Earnhardt guy. What was it about the Intimidator that you liked so much, respected so much?
Oh, man. You know, I saw a lot, even as a young, I want to say 12 when he passed, something like that. But I started following him probably when I was about 8, I would say. I started getting old enough to see some similarities actually between myself in a sense of how he raced and how I played the game, and kind of how my dad groomed me to play the game, which is hard. And, you know, when that ball's hit, my only thought's to catch it, make the play. It's not, okay, where's the wall, or okay, where, you know, it's make the play. And I think that's how he raced. He raced to win every time. And, another thing too, that really, kind of, you know, got me on the whole Dale bandwagon there is how intimidating. Everyone was scared of him, you know, at the track. But as soon as the race was over, you could just tell it was like, this is the real, you know, the real Dale, the Dale that's going back home. Everyone that I've spoken to now, I mean, kind of confirmed that he was just such a great guy off the track. But once those shades came on and he put those Nikes on, it was the Intimidator, and I always liked that. I thought that was really interesting and cool. You know, that he kind of had two different personas. And like myself, I had Scooter and Ryan, so there was another similarity there too. But yeah, man, Dale's the best.
Scooter Jeanette joining us, and Junior's just like that as well. Junior's an unbelievable guy off the track. Good guy on the track, of course, but really unbelievable guy off the track. You know, it's this point that you're making right now, Scooter. For instance, back in February, you were at a middle school in Sarasota, Florida, and you were talking to students there about emotions and times where maybe you felt alone or down. It's part of a larger project that you're involved with, but if we start with that middle school conversation, there are a lot of things that you might be doing in your free time. Why was that something that you wanted to do?
Well, I think, you know, really, I like to call it, you know, mental health. You know, the mental health thing, people are kind of like, whoa, you know. I think it's more, it's mental health. It's how do we help each other? And I think the biggest thing is just sharing, you know, connecting with somebody and just communicating with them, like, really what's going on, whether it's something good or something not so good. I just think nowadays with all the social media and all the other stuff, it's like people put this mask on that, oh, everything's fine. You know, it's not cool to talk about certain things like religion and politics and, you know, money. And, you know, these are things that we're kind of in our culture and our society wired not to talk about. And And I don't understand why, because how are we supposed to learn from each other if we're not talking about those things that are pretty important stuff? You know, we talk about sports, we wear our favorite team's hats, and, you know, people are like, oh, they suck. And you're like, no, your team sucks. And like, but that's, you know, that's fine. And it's like, why can't we talk about, you know, all the other stuff like that? And I think it really hits every area, you know, emotions, maybe what the home life's like. And I just encourage the kids to, you know, if they feel like they can't talk to anybody, like that's one of the most important times probably to find somebody to talk to and use their resources, their guidance counselor, their teacher. When it comes to the bullying stuff, I tell them, you know, you see some bullying going on and you don't do anything about it, you know, really, ultimately, there's no difference between you and the bully other than you're not maybe throwing a punch or tweeting something. And also on the flip side of that, to feel bad for that bully, try to help that bully, you know, because obviously if they're bullying people, then they're probably going home to a rough situation. So I kind of just try to teach them those kind of things. And really the biggest thing, Jim, is letting them know that everyone's dealing with something. You know, even me as a professional athlete, I have issues that I have to deal with on, off the field. And I think everyone does. And it's weird because, like, everyone, when I have those conversations, the teachers are like, oh, thank you so much. And, you know, and like, we understood exactly what you were saying. And it's like, well, why aren't we saying it? Why aren't we talking about it more as a society? And really, I mean, if I can help a couple kids, you know, it's worth it for me. But ultimately, all I'm trying to do now is just talk to the people that I can, you know, communicate with. And that's my teammates, my family, my friends, and just encourage them, you know, even as my buddy makes T-shirts. And even, you know, for him, he can impact a lot of people in all different ways. So just really encouraging people to step out of the normal and do something to help somebody.
Red second baseman Scooter Jeanette joining us. I mean, that's an amazing thing to say right there. In terms of the T-shirts, it's part of a larger project, actually. And there's a shirt that will be sold that simply reads, "Say Hello." Now, I know you've kind of touched on this, but what's the thinking behind that? And what is the message you want to put out there with that shirt?
Yeah, like you said, it says, "Say Hello." It's going to be in red colors to start out. They're going to try to hit the Red Nation with it. Really, the idea is it could be something as simple as just saying hello to somebody and, you know, asking them how their day is and, you know, if they want to talk about something. But, you know, that's kind of what I do on a daily basis, whether it's at the grocery store or wherever I might be. If I notice somebody, whether it's – I like to – there's older ladies, a lot of older ladies in Sarasota where I'm from in the off season, and older men as well, but it seems like at the mall and stuff, there's a lot of older women, and I just love saying stuff like, oh, you look great today, and it's like, at first, they're kind of caught off guard, like, that's not normal to say, but then they smile and say thank you, and they walk away, and it just makes me feel like, it makes me feel good that I might have just brought a smile to some lady's day, and who knows, maybe no one's talking to her for a while, or whatever the case may be. It could be something so simple as just saying hi to somebody and encouraging people to do that, not only as athletes, but, you know, as any citizen.
Scooter, if somebody wants to buy that shirt, how would they go about getting it?
Athletes Brand is the you can find them on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, I'm pretty sure all of it, but they're the ones that are going to be making the shirts and distributing them, selling them. I think the main goal is to, I don't have like a foundation or anything yet. I think that we're still trying to find one that fits the best with what we're trying to do. And, you know, hopefully create some type of movement or campaign to where, and there's some foundations that are doing that. The Goldie Hawn Foundation, she does a really good job at creating programs in schools that gets the kids to learn about, you know, certain emotions and how to deal with them. But really, my end goal is putting enough pressure or create enough awareness on the school systems to implement a class that you could just call life. And that's where basically the kids' attendance is their grade, and they can participate in certain conversations, but yet they're sitting in, and that's when you have your guest speakers come in and you show your movies like the Green Mile and, you know, that kind of stuff to really kind of get these kids, like, you know, ready for, you know, life and what's in store for them after school. And I think that's something that I missed out on and something that I wish I had learned, you know, before I got drafted or whatever. And you know, really just learn more about yourself, learn more about other people. And that's the end goal. So they're like, I don't want any money. I mean, the athlete's brand, they need to sell the shirts and they can make more shirts. And ultimately there's going to be money going to some foundation, but it might cost some money to create some type of movement like that. So, you know, who knows?
Spreading the message. He is a second baseman for the Cincinnati Reds. He is an all-star, and the Reds have a very different look this year. And as he says, they're going to be scary to deal with. Scooter, it's great talking baseball with you. It's great talking life with you. It's always good to have you on this show, and I hope we can do it again soon. That was really good stuff.
Absolutely, Jim. Thanks for having me on, man.
Remember 1989, the year the World Wide Web was invented? Yeah, well, we've come a long way in 30 years. So why does it feel like the software that you use every day at work is stuck in the past? Take a leap into the future by finding the right software for your business on Capterra.com. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Join the millions of people who use Capterra every month to find the right tools for your business. Visit Capterra.com/Rome for free today and find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. Capterra.com/Rome. Capterra, that's CAPTERRA.com/Rome. Capterra, that's CAPTERRA.com/Rome. Now, everybody's thinking about the NCAA tournament, but the New York Giants, for some reason, would like you to not forget about them. And to be honest, it's kind of a weird strategy to me. It's bold. It's aggressive. It's borderline idiotic. Given how things have gone lately, if I were the Giants, I would stay down right now. I'd lay low, stay in my lane, hope that people lose interest, and forget about that dumpster fire that's blazing outside the facility. You know, the kind of things that the Patriots do in the offseason. Last thing, at least this season, offseason. Last thing that I would do is try to get anybody to look at me. But that's exactly what the Giants are doing. Fresh off of blasting off a few toes off their foot with that Odell Beckham trade, they're back at it again. This time, it's GM Dave Gettleman talking about Eli Manning. I mean, all right, that makes some sense. People can disagree about whether drafting a running back where they did last year was a good idea or a bad idea. And they can disagree about whether it's a smart move to sign the best receiver in team history to a huge deal in August and then trade him in March. But if ever there was a topic that you would think would be a layup, it's Eli Manning and his future. And if you think that, Gettleman agrees with you. It is a layup, a total layup. Take it away, Dave.
This narrative that Eli's overpaid and can't play is a crock. I'm telling you.
Wait, what? What did you just say? That's not the layup that I was expecting. Dave Gettleman just took all of your takes on Eli Manning and dunked them in the wrong basket and then pointed at the crowd. You think Eli is overpaid? You think Eli can't play? Man, what a crock.
Crock.
First off, Dave, amazing word selection. Crock.
Crock.
Especially in the context as a shortened version of what you know what he wanted to say. Man, that is a crock of bleep.
Crock.
Using the word crock,
crock
is almost as amazing as saying that the narrative that Eli is overpaid and can't play is a crock.
Crock.
Well, first off, let me make this clear. Eli Manning is a very easy target. No, seriously. He's a really easy target. He's gotten absolutely pummeled on the field and off it the last few years. And people have made this guy into a complete punching bag and blamed everything about the Giants on Eli. Easy target. Having said that, he's handled it all with complete class. When there have been numerous members of that team and that organization who have not handled things professionally, Eli has done so time and time again. So it's not about bashing Eli. The truth is, while he has struggled lately, he's not as bad as everybody makes him out to be. But at the same time, saying this narrative that Eli is overpaid and can't play as a crock, well, that in of itself is a crock. A real crock. A crock of bleep. And he wasn't done either. When talking about whether or not the team was going to bring back Eli Manning in 2019, Gettleman had this to say.
The way he finished the season and what he's making, there really wasn't a decision to make.
Wait, the way you ended the season? You ended the season with three straight losses. One of them was a shutout. Eli had as many picks as he had touchdowns during that stretch. So what about it meant that there was not a decision to make? The only reason why there was not a decision to make is because you didn't look for a better option, and that's on you. You won five games last year. You started the year 1-7. The only reason why the ending of the season did not look as horrible as the beginning of the season is because it couldn't have been any worse than the beginning of the season. And those four wins in the back half of the year came against Frisco, Tampa, Chicago, and Washington. Not exactly a murderer's row. But if you listen to Gettleman, he makes it sound as if they came this close to signing Eli to another extension. The team's gone 8-24 in the last 2 years. They've got a quarterback who is aging out, an offensive line with issues, a defense with holes. You would think now would be the time to start rebuilding. You know, just put some C4 next to the supports, hit the detonator, and go to work. But not Gettleman.
The object of this is to win as many games as possible every year. So we're building. We were 3-13 when I took over. We were 5-11 last year. 12 of those games were a touchdown or less. We're building.
Man, this is really confusing to me. And I would imagine to every Giants fan, because at that point, Giants fans' heads are exploding. I mean, I guess there's a universe in which Gettleman's right, I guess, in theory. But not in reality. Because the Giants have been trying to win and build for the past 2 years, and they've done neither. This is what he's saying. The object is to win and to build, and we're doing both. Yeah, but they won 8 games in the last 2 years. They're not better for it. What the hell were they building? It seemed like they were trading Beckham, and that was a sign that they finally realized we do need to build. We need to rebuild. We're not close to winning. We need to drop a bomb on it and rebuild. But that's not what's going on. It was just that Gettleman was trying to do both and succeeding in neither. Apparently, according to Gettleman, when they traded Odell Beckham and Olivier Vernon and they allowed Landon Collins to walk, they were not rebuilding. That was not about blowing up the team to get better in the future. That was about getting better for this year. You know, the classic move where you take a 5-win team and you get rid of Pro Bowlers and you become a better team. You know that playbook. Step one, win 5 games. Step two, get rid of good players. Step three, keep not good players. Four, win more games. I mean, how many times have you seen that plan? Sounds to me like this guy does not have a plan, or he has multiple plans. But you better not ask him about those plans because it's none of your damn business.
Very honestly, it's not my responsibility to tell you guys what I'm doing. That is not my, just like it's not my responsibility to respond to every rumor that comes down the pike. That's not my job.
I get it. I really do. You don't have to tell the media what you're doing. But your actions tell everybody that you have no idea what you're doing. Hey, Giants fan, are you clear on Gettleman's plan? Because I'm not. In fact, right about now, I'd rather be the Jets than the Giants. And in what lifetime did you ever think that you would hear that?
Crock.
It's a crock, man.
Crock.
Eli is not faded and he's not overpaid. It's an absolute crock.
Crock. I'm telling you.
I'm telling you, Giants fans, it is a crock.
Crock.
Man, I keep waiting for other breaking Giants sign Eli to a 5-year extension. It's a crock.
Crock.
Andy Green is my guest. Andy, it's good to have you back. Thanks for making time. How are you?
Yeah, doing great, Jim. How you doing today?
Super. Great. Andy, great to visit with you. I mentioned you're 14-8 in spring training. I know you're not going to read too much into wins and losses during camp, but how does the team feel to you right now?
That's great. I couldn't even have told you we were 14-8. I think that's how much managers are paying attention to spring training records right now. But the vibe in the clubhouse is good. And a lot of that changed when we added Manny to the clubhouse. I think he raised our collective expectation level. It was huge of ownership to step up like that. You don't see that very often in a small market club, but our owners are they're committed to winning here in San Diego. And you're starting to see a lot of it start to come together. And within the clubhouse now, you know, there's a belief that we're past this development phase and you know, we're ready to go out and compete and do some special things this season.
I love that. I love you jumping right into it. So, of course, that's the big story of the offseason, the signing of Manny Machado. What was your personal reaction when you heard the news that it was official?
I was thrilled. I got it right after I spoke to the team. So my opening message to the team, obviously he wasn't signed right when spring started. I gave my opening message to the team, and about 10 minutes after that, I got the news. So I'm not sure if like I inspired ownership to pony up a little bit more money or not with that opening message to the club. But one way or another, we ended up with Manny, and thrilled about it. And it's been great throughout spring training and looking forward to go through the seasons with him.
Padres manager Andy Green joining us. So obviously you and the organization did a lot of homework and due diligence on that before you made that move. What did you see in Manny Machado that made you feel like he'd be a good fit, not only for the roster, but for your clubhouse?
Yeah, first, just like the way he fits on the club, our most obvious hole was third base. When you take your weakness and turn it into your greatest strength, that's one of the biggest needle movers you're ever going to have in a clubhouse. So we had a place that we didn't really have anybody lined up to play. We had some young guys we were excited about. But to add a gold glove all-star presence in Manny, who's been in the postseason, won games in meaningful situations, to put him in the middle of the order, that changes the lineup construct. And then just looking at a guy that's, fits our window from an age perspective with where our young talent is, somebody that you expect to be anchoring your lineup for years and years to come. And it all just made a ton of sense to us.
We're talking to Andy Green. You mentioned the commitment from ownership and the kind of message that sends everybody in the clubhouse. What about you as the manager? You're always going to have high expectations no matter what. But does the arrival of Machado change those expectations for you? Does it shift into even more of a win now mode for you?
Yeah, we want to win. We want to win every baseball game we play. I know there's 29 other managers going to tell you the exact same thing. Knowing where we've come from, there were years where doing that was very difficult. And now you look out across the field and your lineup stacks up well against the opposition. You might not be the best club on the field every single night from a talent perspective, but you're plenty good enough to go out there and beat people and win games on a consistent basis. And I think the way we look at ourselves now is every single year there's a team or two that shocks people. It ends up in the playoffs, and we think we're every bit in that category to be in that consideration, and we're the type of club that's going to go out and not look long-term, but just focus on every single day that we have in front of us. And, our first one that's going to count is going to be against Madison Bumgarner here in a little over a week. And our guys are excited about that one and looking forward to it.
This is San Diego Padres manager Andy Green, my guest. So one more thought about Machado. You've had some time around him. So what kind of an impact do you expect him to have on young guys like maybe Fernando Tatis Jr.?
A really solid one. He's been an unbelievable teammate from the second he walked in this clubhouse. When you dig deep on him and you start talking to people in clubhouses that have known him and been around him, they talk about his character. They talk about what kind of guy he is and that he cares about people and wants to win. He's motivated and driven. It's not the narrative that gets spun publicly sometimes, but when you get close proximity to him, it's what you walk away with and that's what you feel. And I think he's gelled seamlessly within the clubhouse. And when it comes to Fernando Tatis Jr., Manny's probably the only guy around here that can relate what it's like being a phenom at 19 years old, where everybody has incredibly high expectations of you. And he's lived up to those expectations. And I think he's going to have some insights and some wisdom to pass on. And the relationship already seems incredibly strong. And we're excited about his impact on him. But the main thing we're concerned about is him going out and playing baseball. We just want Manny to be Manny. We want him to play baseball. We want him to play baseball well. All that other stuff's going to take care of itself.
So, Andy, let me keep you on Tatis for a minute. He's had so much hype and so much buzz. He only turned 20 earlier this season. How high is his ceiling?
I think he'll determine that in time. We're excited about him. I ain't excited about the intent with which he's approached spring training, the intent he's taken every ground ball with, the work he's doing in the cage. Because if this kid keeps his head down and works, he's going to be really, really good for a really long time. And I think he's wired the right way to do that and not be concerned about the hype. It's a different day and age where, you know, 19 and 20-year-old kids who have never put on a big league uniform are getting hyped up and put on the covers of magazines and previews and talked about as the next coming. And they really haven't done anything. But he's taken it very well. He's kept his head down. And I think ultimately we're really excited about his future. The steps he's taken defensively this spring from last spring when I was around him, man, it's a testament to his work ethic and all our minor league guys who have touched him. And then obviously he went to winter ball this offseason, played incredibly well for his dad. So they ended up winning the championship in the DR for the first time in 51 years for that club. And he was right there in the middle of it, hitting in the three hole, playing in high pressure environments and thrived on it. So he's got a bright future. All he's got to do is focus on today and he's going to get there.
It's an exciting time for the Padres. We're talking baseball with their manager, Andy Green, for a few more moments. He's not the only young talent you have. Luis Urias, who's 21, he's also really a different guy, a different kind of player. What makes him so unique?
Yeah, it's his on-base skills. We've talked about it organizationally for a long time. We need guys who get on base. You know, for the last 5 years, that even precedes me, this team's finished 30th in Major League Baseball in on-base percentage. Luis Urias is a guy throughout his minor league career has gotten on base to 400 clip, and he swings at strikes, he takes balls, and he puts the ball in play with some authority. And, you know, he can flat defend the field, too. Played a really good second base for us last year when he came up. He's coming into camp playing a lot of shortstop, and he's been very, very consistent over there at short. And I think when you look at those guys and talk about Ian Kinsler in that mix, you know, it's an infield to be very excited about, especially with Eric Hosmer over at first base.
We're talking to Andy Green. Speaking of Hosmer, you know, it was a challenging year for him last year. I'm sure it didn't go exactly the way that he had hoped that it would. What do you expect from him this year? It's more of a normal offseason due to the fact that he's not a free agent. What kind of an Eric Hosmer are you expecting to see this year?
He's looked great in spring training. And I think we look at this season and expect him to have kind of the all-star caliber seasons he's had so frequently in his career. And his swing looks really good. He's driving the balls all over the ballpark. And like, we're excited about him. We're excited about when we signed him. And last year didn't change that at all. We think he's the guy that's going to anchor the clubhouse and be a key leader for us and hit in the middle of the order for us. And have loved, you know, the way he came into the season, the way he's attacked it, and the way he's brought that whole clubhouse together.
So, Andy, talking to you right now, I'm not at all surprised by this, but you're absolutely locked in. You're really dialed in. And I bring this up because I talked with some of your colleagues in the NL West recently, like Dave Roberts, Troy Lovello, in spring training. And one of the biggest topics has been, what do they do in the offseason? Do they unplug? Do they try and rest and recover and restore in the offseason? How do you personally go about doing that? Do you try to get away from baseball for a little bit of time?
Yeah, I wish I could sometimes, but I mean, obviously I'm passionate about this, as are those guys. The one thing that pulls me away well from baseball and gets me my focus elsewhere is I got three little girls. I got a 12-year-old and 10-year-old twins, and I'm watching ballet recitals and soccer games and being a dad, being a husband and a dad, and that's about the only thing that pulls me away from this passion in San Diego. And my kids they're ate up with the Padres and they're ate up with the city of San Diego. And like, we want to see something happen special in the city. And, you know, my family's firmly invested in that.
Andy, what's it like having three girls? I've got two boys, so that's the only life I know. What's it like having three little girls?
Yeah, my world's painted pink at home, man. It's good. It's the only change of pace, like I said, I have in life. And, we haven't hit those teenage years yet. So they still think dad's awesome. I'm not sure when that changes. But I'm hoping it doesn't change at all ever.
Like I said, I can't help you with that. One last thought. There have been rumors about the team maybe looking to make a move when it comes to the rotation, maybe even adding a big name. I know you can't comment on specific names, but overall, how do you feel about the rotation at this point?
Yeah, I think it's by far and away the youngest rotation I've had since I've been here, and by far and away the most talented rotation we've looked at since we've been here. So those aren't bad. That's not a bad thing, being young. There's a lot of upside. And I'm going into this season, and we're going into the season with the expectation that the guys we have in camp are the guys that are going to be here. And we're not lacking anything other than experience. And I'd rather lack experience than talent at this point in time, because we've had some experienced guys in the past. And these young guys, some of these guys are coming in with a real edge to them and a real hunger and a real desire. And it's a credit to our scouts who identified them, They're made the right way. They're wired to want to win. And our PD department's done a great job with these guys. So I like the spot we're at. People aren't going to know the names that comprise our rotation and our bullpen, but by the time they're done seeing some of them, they're going to remember their names.
It's been an amazing offseason, really exciting time right now for the San Diego Padres. He's entering his fourth season as the manager, and the Padres do open up their season against San Francisco on March 28th. It's coming fast. Andy Green, my guest. Andy, I so appreciate you coming on. Thanks for making time. Always good to talk baseball with you.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Good night now!